Well, good afternoon, everybody who's dialed in. My name is Russ Olmsted. I'm your moderator for this afternoon's session and would like to acknowledge and thank Weber Training for including me in this webinar broadcast. And I think you've all received the slide sets prior to today's call. So we'll have our faculty member kind of guide you through that, indicate which slide she's on as she goes through. So very pleased and honored to be able to host this session, and our faculty today is Dr. Taranesia McConnell. She's a healthcare epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta and is going to be reviewing the topic today is practical management of norovirus-infected patients in healthcare settings, and particularly fortunate in that Dr. McConnell actually assisted the Healthcare Infection Control Praxis Advisory Committee, the CDC committee that deals with developing guidance on prevention of infections. And in this particular session, she'll be highlighting pieces of the new recommendations that were developed by HCPCS under their guidelines for prevention of norovirus infection. So very pleased to have Dr. McConnell here. She was instrumental on development of these guidelines and had the privilege of serving on HCPCS when these were developed. So my background, I'm Director of Infection Prevention and Control Services at St. Joseph Mercy Health System, and we're located in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and very pleased to have you join us this afternoon. Also would like to thank our sponsor for today's session is Virox and the makers of surface disinfectants, so appreciate the support for that and thrilled that you're tuning in for this session. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. McConnell.
Thanks so much, Russ. So today we'll be talking about primarily the new HCPCS guidelines for prevention and management of norovirus in healthcare settings. Before I continue, I just wanted to obviously state our disclaimer that the findings and conclusions of this presentation are of those of the authors, but not necessarily representing the official position of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So with that, I will start on our next slide. So that would be slide two. So just to set the stage a little bit, I did want to talk a little bit about the background. Many of you, I'm sure, out in healthcare are very familiar with norovirus, particularly in the long-term care facility setting, but certainly acute care is not to be spared from this great little bug. But norovirus is one of the most common causes of acute gastroenteritis outbreaks in the community as well as in healthcare settings. We note that approximately 21 million infections occur every year just in the U.S. alone. The symptoms of norovirus infection do vary, but one of the classic features that you do see is a sudden onset of non-bloody diarrhea and vomiting primarily, and that's primarily in adults, but can also include things like nausea, cramping, malaise, and fever. Symptoms are generally pretty self-limiting, and the duration of illness does vary, but it does sort of cluster very closely around the range from 2 to 5 days. So the next slide. Certainly, it is very close to being a perfect pathogen in that its inoculating dose is very, very small. The literature has shown that as little as 10 viral particles can start infection, and persisting immunity after illness is actually very limited, even among healthy persons. So you will get an infection even among healthy individuals, and that protection from natural immunity only lasts from weeks to months. The short incubation period of norovirus is particularly well suited to this pathogen, and we have seen literature that has reported as little of an incubation of 10 to 12 hours, but typically we see an incubation before you see an onset of symptoms between 24 and 48 hours. And again, it is a very well-suited pathogen for environments, even harsh environments, as well as temperatures, and can last in those environments for extended periods. Not only the environments do include things like just general surfaces, but can include hands of healthcare workers, hands of just general people, as well as food contamination. One of the detriments to us is that many household disinfectants really don't have a lot of activity against norovirus, and a lot of these disinfectants actually don't carry the claim that they have activity against norovirus. It's a very difficult bug to study in vitro as human strains, so the ones that infect you and I, have not been able to be successfully cultured in regular cell lines. So it's difficult to basically implement any kind of study to see how these strains behave in vitro. Next slide. So in terms of a very brief history of where this bug came from, it's a fairly contemporary pathogen, really identified in the early 70s using electron microscopy as the cause of what was previously known and previously documented probably as far back as the 30s and 20s as winter vomiting disease. It was previously thought to only really affect children and adults, and older adults, but the virus was originally named Norwalk virus after a school outbreak in Norwalk, Ohio in 1968. So if there's any of those of you in Ohio, shout out to your state. Since then, though, the major cause of viral gastroenteritis worldwide. So this doesn't just apply to the North American audience, but certainly all over, and may cause up to greater than 50% of all acute gastroenteritis outbreaks. Seroprevalence studies do show that 80 to 90% of those who are by the time we reach young adulthood, we have been already exposed to this organism. And major human groups representing genogroup 1 and 2 with genogroup 2.4 do predominate in greater than 74% of outbreaks. The ones we do see in healthcare are primarily genogroup 2.4. Next slide. So the modes of transmission that we do see in healthcare, the primary mechanism that we see is contact transmission. So that is a person-to-person transmission, typically through the fecal-oral route. And that can entail, you know, basically a direct transmission, which unfortunately means either through vomiting or direct exposure to fecal material. You know, it doesn't take much, as we mentioned, to start that process of infection. So it doesn't. You may not even notice that you are handling, you know, very small quantities of norovirus that may be contained in either vomitus or from fecal residue, as well as through indirect transmission through things like fomites, so things that are in the environment, inanimate objects. So if a person who has norovirus does contaminate like bed rails or chairs or handles, and you happen to touch it and you are able to ingest it, that can also start that contact transmission process. Other modes of transmission that we have seen is also the sort of through short-range aerosols. It's not necessarily airborne, but definitely the literature does point to projectile vomiting, sort of just, again, short-range aerosols that can propagate norovirus through larger communities. And also we have intrinsic as well as extrinsic contamination of food and water, and a lot of that is, you know, couched upon food preparation, and water tends to be more of, you know, in large contamination of sort of water supply systems. Next slide. So in terms of, well, how much does it cost to actually manage these types of outbreaks in healthcare? Well, they do come with a fairly high price tag, not necessarily very high morbidity, but in terms of its management, the estimates that we have seen in the literature have estimated, in the United States at least, so a price tag of about $650,000, and that was for an outbreak that prolonged itself over 17 weeks with over 350 cases. So that's a fairly decent-sized outbreak. In Europe, in Switzerland, and there was a sort of more finite-sized outbreak of 2 weeks with only 16 cases, but that still was an excess cost of $40,000 to manage. And in the United Kingdom, where they do actually do a lot of heavy surveillance for norovirus and have expended a lot of yearly dollars in managing these types of outbreaks, in a more recent study, it was estimated that approximately $1 million was infused per 1,000 beds to manage these outbreaks. And overall, over the two-year course in which this was being under surveillance, $184 million was expended to the English National Health Service, which included, you know, this particular longitudinal study was looked at over three health systems, and over 3,400 cases were reported in 227 outbreaks. So, you know, great numbers of outbreaks and lots of pockets of infection throughout a two-year period. Costs do include lost revenue, which does entail, you know, closure of wards, plus the measures such as healthcare personnel that need to be replaced because they are sick, the sick time of those healthcare personnel that they, you know, need to, you know, take. Be outside of the healthcare facility, and so that is also a measure of lost productivity, environmental cleaning, as well as the isolation precautions that need to be implemented to control these outbreaks. Next slide. Some of the challenges with norovirus in healthcare settings, if it wasn't clearly obvious by now, was that some of the institutional settings, particularly long-term care facilities, but also acute care, report, you know, greater than 50% of these types of outbreaks, but they may many are become associated with outbreaks that are not necessarily have its initial start in healthcare, but on cruise liners and banquets, hotels, et cetera. And again, typically with the short duration of illness, it can lead to prolonged lengths of stay, particularly in those who have other comorbidities under their belt, as well as, you know, things like severe dehydration and electrolyte imbalances, as well as can lead to some more severe circumstances like renal insufficiencies as a result of, you know, these norovirus infections. Even though they are generally short in duration, they can sort of have these prolonged effects. Outbreaks can be very protracted and can go on and on and on for weeks on end and can be very difficult to control with very indiscriminate infectivity to almost any population, and which is why you see, if you've ever looked at the literature, you've seen or have had first-hand experience that, you know, as many patients as staff tend to become infected. So it really is geared to anybody and also with that low infectious dose. Next slide. So to address some of these things and to at least coalesce all of the information that is out there in the literature that's relevant for basically placing together some recommendations to help with this management of norovirus outbreaks, we decided to embark on a process to create a guideline to address norovirus outbreaks and management in healthcare. And so some of the things that we do as part of the HCPCS guideline process is to create something that we can actually develop rapidly and update those guidelines to allow for an appropriate response to things that may change in terms of the new scientific evidence that may come out. And so we have search strategies that have been implemented, and we can refer back to them and rerun those strategies with new timeframes to basically update these guidelines as necessary and as, you know, as the body of knowledge becomes larger or maybe steers us in a new direction. It's also to address the key clinical questions of infection preventionists and providers in a targeted way. So each of these guidelines, this was the second that used this particular format, was, you know, we consulted with a number of people outside of CDC, so a lot of experts in the field, to kind of identify things that were most relevant to IPs and other healthcare providers to help, you know, answer the questions that they needed answered. Also, it's a process to make use of the most available evidence to answer the questions efficiently. Sometimes we did find out that the process actually let us know what wasn't in the literature, so that was actually a very good tool because it helped us identify a research agenda for this particular organism and for infection control measures, for answering questions about infection control measures in the future. And also to provide transparent recommendations without bias. And I'll explain a little bit about how that process goes in a couple of slides from now. But basically to try and replicate, you know, so if you had the same body of evidence that we assessed with that search strategy that we used against the literature, would you be able to come up with relatively similar recommendations based on what was garnered from the literature searches? And then also prioritize those recommendations for implementation. It's great to put out, you know, 200 recommendations, but you need to be able to figure out what actually works and what you would use as a sort of top-tier strategies for implementing during an outbreak. Next slide. So in terms of evaluating the evidence, we have recently, and recently by I mean by about 5 years ago or so, recently adopted the GRADE methodology. And GRADE stands for the Grades of Recommendation, Assessment, Development, and Evaluation for evidence-based recommendations. And so the strength of those recommendations, and you'll see it later on, and if you've seen any of the other HCPCS guidelines, you see that we have a very familiar and similar structuring of how evidence sort of shakes out and what has more strength in terms of the evidentiary base behind it. So the strength of our evidence depends on the type of evidence, and clearly randomized controlled trials or RCTs, systematic reviews have the most sort of weight in terms of giving us the best evidence because they are hopefully unbiased and more randomly selected, so you get better results, as well as, you know, what does sort of especially for this particular bug, observational studies and descriptive reports tend to also make up a lot of what we detected in the searches for evidence. We also have to, in the process of doing this, balance what is known in terms of risk and what is unknown in terms of both risk and benefit for those recommendations. And we always kept in mind what is a net benefit and would that net benefit be greater than any net harm as a result of any recommendations that we submitted. Also, the quality of evidence was assessed and the quality of the analysis. So both of those factored in quite heavily in terms of how recommendations were crafted. Next slide. So in terms of the HCPCS categorization scheme for recommendations, and this is a lot of text on this slide, but basically there's a Category 1A, which is the strong recommendation. It is supported by high to moderate quality evidence, and basically it suggests net clinical benefits over harm. And Category 1B, which is also a strong recommendation. So any of the Category 1s are strong recommendations. And for this particular category, it is considered basically an accepted practice, even if it was supported by low to very low quality evidence. So that's something to just keep in mind, because that's a little bit different than guidelines that have not used the GRADE methodology before. In Category 1C, that usually is a strong recommendation, but it's also backed by federal or state regulations. And Category 2, which is a weak recommendation, but it's supported by any level of quality evidence suggesting some sort of trade-off, preferably toward clinical benefits and harm. So you basically, it's almost even, but it may be worth considering. So you'll see the language being, particularly for Category 2s, we word them saying, consider this, or, you know, this should be something that you might have as sort of second tier. And then obviously there's recommendations for further research where we had an unresolved issue where there is low or to very low quality evidence and with uncertain trade-offs between benefit and harm. Next slide. So the guidelines key questions, and we originally started out with 5. We probably started out with 25, but we had 5 to begin with. And as the evidence sort of came in and we were pooling our, what was gleaned from each of the studies, we actually came up with 3 main questions. So the first one was, what person, virus, or environmental characteristics increase or decrease the risk of norovirus infection in healthcare settings? 2, what are the best methods to identify a norovirus outbreak in healthcare settings? And 3, what interventions best prevent or contain norovirus outbreaks in healthcare settings? And as you know, the entire guideline is on our CDC website, but then also it was just recently published in the Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology Journal. Next slide. So now we'll get into some of the key infection control recommendations. The guideline is broken down into several sort of major headings. There's approximately about 10, I'd say. And so in patient cohorting and isolation precautions, one of the main features we want to highlight is obviously something that's pretty obvious, but we might as well state it, and that is avoid exposure to vomitus or diarrhea. Place patients on contact precautions in a single occupancy room if they have symptoms consistent with norovirus gastroenteritis. So you'll notice here that it doesn't say that norovirus has been confirmed, but they do have symptoms consistent with norovirus. Just because we know how fast this organism can spread, it is better to err on the side of being conservative and place those who are symptomatic on contact precautions is potentially a lot better than leaving them out in a shared environment if this is indeed norovirus and you find that out later. When patients with norovirus gastroenteritis cannot be accommodated in those single occupancy rooms, efforts should be made to separate them from asymptomatic patients. This basically means cohorting, and that may include placing patients in those multiply occupied rooms, or designated patient care facilities and areas or contiguous sections within a facility for patient cohorting. So this may mean using a 4-bed room and putting those who have norovirus or suspected norovirus together, and ideally have the ability for them not to have to share a restroom or toilet, but in those circumstances, when you do not have those resources, then it might have to occur in that way. And then also, it may be more than one room that has to be designated for those patient care areas that need to be cordoned off or considered basically areas of isolation and multiple rooms of those dedicated to norovirus patients. Next slide. So some of the practical challenges with isolating and cohorting, and all of you out there who do clinical practice do know this already, that isolation rooms may not be the typical single room. Single patient rooms as well, bathrooms as well, and long-term care may not exist. The other question that we often get is, should you move patients to cohort them? Sometimes you could do a little bit more damage by actually having, you know, playing the bed shuffle and moving them all over to try and get them onto one side or one wing of a hospital ward. So that needs to be considered carefully in terms of, you know, what kind of terminal cleaning needs to be done, and do you have to move, can you just move them once and that's it, or will they have to move multiple times? Isolating non-compliant populations is also, and it's always very challenging, and may require additional built environment controls, such as actually closing sections off with doors and stuff like that, where you still are able to observe patients, but then they are not able to move freely between areas that are considered not exposed. And then also cohorting among like sex and like disease status patients can be kind of an issue and may not provide those dedicated toilets or commodes, and these may become a very complicated issue just in the process of trying to make it simple. Next slide. For hand hygiene, we have several recommendations, and I'm just going to highlight a few here. So during outbreaks, use soap and water for hand hygiene after providing care or having contact with patients suspected or confirmed with norovirus. That is a Category 1B, so that's considered practice, like best practice. And so for all other hand hygiene indications, i.e., before having contact with norovirus patients, you can refer to our 2002 HCPCS guideline for hand hygiene in healthcare settings, which does include the indications for use of FDA-compliant alcohol-based hand sanitizer. And then also, here again is a Category 2 where we say consider ethanol-based hand sanitizers with 60 to 95% content of ethanol as the preferred active agent for hand hygiene compared to other alcohol or non-alcohol-based hand sanitizer products. Next slide. So interpreting the use of soap and water versus alcohol-based hand sanitizer during norovirus outbreaks is something we do get asked about. So when do you use hand sanitizer for hand hygiene? From evaluating the evidence and comparing it to our hand hygiene guideline, the best place to use it during these types of outbreaks for hand sanitizer is before caring for diarrheal patients. We know that even though we focus on these norovirus or these gastroenteritis outbreaks, there are still other people in the ward who don't have diarrhea, who are still have MRSA, who still have VRE, and still have, you know, other pathogens of interest that do respond to hand sanitizer. So in those cases, before you are handling anyone with, you know, incontinence or diarrhea, you still can use a hand sanitizer and it will be an effective product for you. So that would be the second bullet, before and after care patients without norovirus under the diagnosis. And then also when hands are still not been visibly contaminated, so other things that you are doing, like charting, for example, where there isn't, you know, potential that you would have had any cross-contamination with any sort of fecal material, norovirus or otherwise. So when do we preferentially want to use soap and water for hand hygiene? And so this is where you're primarily focusing the use of soap and water, and that is after the care of any diarrheal patient, really irrespective of whether it's norovirus or C. diff, or those suspected or confirmed with norovirus. So even when gloves are worn, after you're caring for a diarrheal patient, you take the gloves off and you wash with soap and water. And then also, as always, when hands have been visibly contaminated. Unfortunately, the data has been inconclusive in terms of what method is more efficacious for norovirus. The log reductions when you use alcohol-based hand sanitizer with norovirus and soap and water are actually fairly equal. So like we said, neither method is actually proven to be better. But the one thing that soap and water does have an advantage of is it's because it's a mechanical action that you can actually reduce bioburden by rinsing all that stuff stuff down the sink, that sort of does put you in a better position for potentially better hand decontamination when these circumstances are, you know, very infectious. So next slide. In terms of other key control measures, patient transfer and ward closure is one that tends to be kind of hot topics when, particularly with these types of outbreaks. So consider limiting transfers to those for which the receiving facility is able to maintain contact precautions. So that means when a patient needs to go and they are still either actively diarrheal or still vomiting, if you need to transfer them out, the receiving facility should be able to maintain those contact precautions. If it's not able to do that, it may be prudent to postpone the transfer until patients no longer require precautions. So during outbreaks, though, medically suitable individuals, so everything else being equal, those who are recovering from just norovirus and would normally be able to be discharged can actually be discharged to their place of residence. So that's something to keep in mind. Again, this is not strong evidence, but is one to consider. Next slide. Some of those practical issues with transferring as well as discharging symptomatic patients is that the receiving facilities or clinical areas may be really reticent to accept a patient requiring isolation resources. So that is a problem we come up with time and time again, and there's no easy answer to that. But it's good to think about and maybe something for as a point of discussion in terms of how, you know, how these things get managed in the future. Challenges to discharging patients to residential environments where the environmental cleaning is not as frequent, and we know that, it's where, you know, community events, unrestricted visitors or guests can actually exacerbate the problem. It can also be a difficulty, especially if you know that these circumstances that they're, you know, they're the places that they're going to will be actually less controlled in terms of keeping bioburden down and environmental cleaning up. So just something to consider. Next slide. In terms of diagnostics, in the absence of clinical laboratory diagnostics or in the case of a delay in obtaining laboratory results to confirm norovirus, we suggest using Kaplan's criteria, which is outlined below in the slide. So Kaplan's criteria is actually suggested way back in 1982. So what that means is you look at your population, and if there is vomiting in more than half of your symptomatic cases, whether it be 5 cases or 10 cases, as well as if the mean incubation period seems to be rather quick, within 24 to 48 hours, and then the mean duration seems to also be fairly short turnaround from 12 to 60 hours, and also no other bacterial pathogen has been isolated in stool culture, then you're probably looking at a norovirus outbreak. A lot of people know this intuitively, but there is criteria to set that out, and so that would be something for consideration. Next slide. Again, with the diagnostic challenges, and there are many, often norovirus is really not on anyone's, you know, differential diagnosis unless you happen to be just coming out of one or have heard that, you know, down the street there's an outbreak going on. It tends not to be on people's radar versus something like C. difficile. And so the orders for EIA, which is a little bit more archaic, but or PCR, is really not done. Specimens for noroviruses should be taken during the acute phase of illness, and that usually means within 3 days of onset. This bug is very elusive, and so the recovery of norovirus from stool specimens is better as you're closer to the time of onset. They're very elusive to isolate. Some patients only present with acute vomiting, so that lowers the sensitivity of norovirus detection when you send a specimen, but you can actually send a specimen containing just vomitus. And it really depends on what your lab is able to do, but here at CDC we do say, you know, that stool specimens are definitely preferred, but vomitus can actually help in detecting norovirus in some individuals that cannot produce a stool sample. The morbidity or mortality risk is not high, so it tends not to be something that, you know, clinicians sometimes want to test for, because it's like, well, you know, this will pass. It'll be done in a couple of hours. This is like a stomach flu. And so it tends also not to be on the radar of clinicians because there isn't a significant, compared to other pathogens, risk of mortality or morbidity. Healthcare facilities may have criteria for also batching specimens, and only after an outbreak is declared. So it's kind of like a chicken and the egg circumstance, but sometimes you actually have to wait until those specimens are batched together for processing, and that could be, you know, time lost. Detection of norovirus is usually low overall in any kind of specimen. So like I said, they're very elusive, again, pointing to getting a specimen as early as possible. And of course, even with a diagnosis, it doesn't really assist with getting any sort of different treatment because there isn't a lot. So a lot of it is just rehydration therapy and just, you know, comfort measures. Next slide. The validation of Kaplan's criteria has been done. It was done in 2006, and it was applied to over 4,000 known and unknown foodborne gastroenteritis outbreaks reported to CDC over several years. It did actually perform quite well, and just keep in mind, this wasn't healthcare-associated outbreaks. These were foodborne outbreaks, but even among those outbreaks, and there were numerous outbreaks to analyze, the Kaplan's criteria did demonstrate very high specificity, so 99%, and moderate sensitivity, but overall its positive predictive value was fairly high at 97%. Other ratios, so other criteria that was identified within this study, looked at different types of ratios, and they didn't perform quite as well. So Kaplan criteria was included in the HCPAC guideline as a, sort of a clinical way of identifying an outbreak without the diagnostics under your belt. Next slide. Environmental cleaning actually takes up a good chunk of this guideline, and if you've had any experience with this bug, you would see why. So some of the things that we want people to take home from this guideline and this particular talk is that with environmental cleaning, we do want folks to increase the frequency of cleaning and disinfection of patient care areas and frequently touched or high-touch surfaces during outbreaks. That is a Category 1B. Now, for example, what does that mean? That means increasing ward or unit-level cleaning from twice, often even to three times daily to maintain cleanliness. And those particularly high-touch surfaces may actually be cleaned and disinfected up to three times daily using EPA-approved products, at least here in the U.S., for healthcare settings. And these sort of guidance, these examples, do come from other studies that we evaluated during the guideline process. Next slide. So cleaning and disinfecting shared equipment between patients must be carried out using EPA-registered products with label claims for use in healthcare. So one of the things that we do want to make mention is to follow manufacturer's recommendations for the application of the product as well, and I stress this, the contact time that is noted on the product label. The EPA does list products with activity against norovirus, and that's listed below. There's the website, and so they have a section all geared towards just norovirus, and so you'll see all the products that have registration and claims for activity against it. Next slide. So what do we mean by EPA registered or approved disinfectants with label claims for norovirus? So in the fine print, EPA regulates and approves disinfectants under the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. So that's probably why they call it FIFRA, but e.g., antimicrobial pesticides. But they have no governing regulation over detergents and cleaning agents. So what you're looking for is primarily a label for disinfectants from the EPA. Now, when disinfectants have specific label claims for norovirus, they have to demonstrate over multiple trials and dilutions of virucidal efficacy, and they must demonstrate a greater than 4 log reduction against the, pretty well known as the standard currently of feline caliche virus, so FCV, because as we mentioned earlier, human norovirus is not cultivable in culture. So we use a proxy, and that's the feline version of this virus. Products with labels specifying use in healthcare must also demonstrate and set out how to apply the material or product, as well as those contact time instructions in these settings. And that includes those that have claims as a cleaner as well as a disinfectant. Next slide. So some of the further recommendations is cleaning and disinfecting surfaces starting from areas with a lower likelihood of contamination, so things like trays, countertops, to areas with very high levels of contamination, things like toilets, bathroom fixtures, et cetera. Also, just to note that we, as part of this recommendation, we do state to change mop heads when a new bucket of cleaning solution is prepared or after cleaning large spills of either emesis or fecal material. And so this is a Category 1B. Next slide. As you see by the wording, this is a category 2, but consider avoiding the use of upholstered furniture and rugs or carpets in patient care areas, as these objects are difficult to clean and disinfect completely. This is not specific to norovirus, I'm sure you recognize, but just the fact that these are porous items, it makes it very difficult for disinfectants to penetrate and do their activity as stated when, you know, there's so many other factors that sort of it can impede that activity when you have upholstered materials or rugs or carpets. Again, so, you know, practically speaking, if this option is not possible, immediately clean soilage such as emesis or fecal material from upholstery using a manufacturer-approved cleaning agent or detergent, and then opt for the future, I guess, opt for seating in patient care areas that can withstand those routine cleanings and disinfections. So just to keep in mind. Next slide. Also, consider steam cleaning of upholstered furniture in patient rooms upon discharge. Consult with manufacturer's recommendations for cleaning and disinfection of these items. And also consider discarding items that cannot be appropriately cleaned and disinfected. That's a really bold statement to make, but sometimes, you know, that just needs to be done, because if you have something that really cannot be addressed in terms of cleaning or disinfection, then there is really no way of addressing it, and so it may be worth just discarding them. Also, just to note that appropriate personal protective equipment should be worn during these types of activities to make sure that healthcare personnel are safe and don't inadvertently aerosolize anything while they're in the process of cleaning. So in terms of looking at the data on disinfectant classes, the challenge in evaluating our basic science data that we pulled for this particular guideline was that the trials that were executed in the lab can use a variety of the product formulations. Really, they could green up anything they would like. And at the time that we evaluated these products, some of them were actually considered off-label uses in terms of the concentration that were used in the papers that we read, as well as the contact times. Some of the contact times were really, really extended contact times, like in upwards of, you know, half an hour or 2 hours, et cetera, so things that would not be practical. Some products that were tested and reviewed for this guideline were not registered for use in the U.S. By the EPA. And then also some had explored the use of different surrogate models and different substrates that were really not familiar with how they, you know, benchmark against EPA standards. As well, several studies seem to use also a 3-log reduction as a benchmark for what they would consider inactivation, but really that benchmark is set by the EPA currently at a 4-log reduction for complete inactivation in this circumstance. So basic science studies did show the most consistent, all those things considered, that the most consistent performance was with the hypochlorite, so typically known as bleach. So controlling the level of environmental contamination, next slide, does have several facets, and that is cleaning and disinfecting equipment and surfaces you need to consider the EPA-approved products with label claims for norovirus, feline calicivirus, again, is the surrogate and pretty much the standard, and instructions for use in healthcare settings. Also, both cleaning and disinfection, and for example, contact time steps will have to be outlined as well as followed. Those are really important for success in, you know, basically using these products to their maximum potential. And then addressing frequently touch surfaces, so define things as bed rails, toilets, bed trays, IV poles, and pumps. And the frequency of both unit level and or ward level cleaning and isolation room cleaning and disinfection is really important too. And as I mentioned, some studies did support increased frequency upwards of, you know, 3 times daily. Next slide. So during outbreaks, you need to change your privacy curtains when they are visibly soiled or upon patient discharge or transfer. A lot of times, as you may be aware, privacy curtains don't even get addressed on just any discharge. So they tend to be this great fomite, and they're porous materials usually. So we are stating here, at least for norovirus, that these privacy curtains need to go after discharge or transfer. Also, handle soiled linens carefully without agitating them to avoid any kind of dispersal of virus. Also, be wearing appropriate PPE when you're doing this. And this is just part of standard precautions, but it is worth mentioning here as well, because, you know, these things have to occur with, you know, increasing speed as, you know, as beds need to be flipped and other patients need to be placed in them. Also, double bagging, incineration, or modifications for laundering are really not indicated for handling or processing soiled linen. Again, this is a category 2, but may be worth considering during outbreak control. Next slide. So in terms of data using the feline Caliche virus as a surrogate model for human norovirus, we have found that there's several issues. One is that the human norovirus strains cannot be cultivated. The main surrogate is FCV, but it is a respiratory pathogen among cats, and so it's not as pH stable because it is not subjected to the gastric acids and stuff like that we would normally see in a fecal, oral, or a true gastrobug, and it may not be a suitable comparison to human norovirus physiochemical properties. So some of the alternate surrogates that have been proposed, and the most sort of recent that's been explored, is a murine norovirus, and it does seem to be a front runner because while it shows it basically manifests as hepatitis or pneumonia or a nervous system pathogen in mice, it is still transmitted through the fecal-oral route, and so it has a wider spectrum of tolerances in terms of the range of pH and temperatures that it can withstand, and may be a better surrogate than FCV. Next slide. So in terms of the other control measures that we have considered, we have staff leave and policy. So develop and adhere to sick leave policies for healthcare personnel who have symptoms consistent with norovirus infection. So that's just saying you should have a policy in the event that these types of outbreaks occur, that you have a plan of what to do with your healthcare personnel who fall ill. Exclude ill personnel from work for a minimum of 48 hours after the resolution of symptoms. So not only the time they would be away would be the time of illness, but then 48 hours after they are resolved of symptoms. And once personnel return to work, the importance of performing frequent hand hygiene really needs to be stressed, especially before and after each patient contact. And we say that because we are not entirely sure, and the evidence is, variable, that some people can actually continue to shed norovirus for 2 to 3 weeks, particularly in younger individuals, but it's been shown that people can still excrete the virus. We don't know whether that virus is infective, but we just know that people do continue to shed it. So that's why the stress on the hand hygiene. Also, establishing protocols for staff cohorting as in the event of an outbreak. So this is basically to ensure that staff care for one patient cohort on their ward and don't move between patient cohorts. So if you're a staff member and you're looking after those who are completely symptomatic, then even during breaks or lunchtime, you're not moving to another cohort and caring for patients who are either unexposed or new admissions. So that we just ensure that the chain of transmission is broken by, having everybody in one side of things. So also excluding non-essential personnel, students and volunteers from working in areas experiencing norovirus outbreaks. And that's, fairly common sense. Next slide. Some of the practical issues with staff leave during norovirus outbreaks is, how do you manage the fact that you may have, a lot of staff attrition as a result of these outbreaks, but needing to keep safe staffing levels on track to manage all these patients? And that is a tricky circumstance, especially if these outbreaks are occurring in very highly skilled, highly specialized clinical areas where, you can't pull casual staff or float staff from other areas to help out. Some of the other issues are lack of sufficient paid leave for those who are ill and don't have enough sick time, to actually be away for that duration of time. So, potentially up to 4 days being off of work. Issues with interpreting the resolution of illness prior to coming to CDC, I used to work in the clinical setting, and so these were some issues in terms of staff not wanting to wait the additional 48 hours or greater after the resolution of symptoms because they felt okay. They're like, well, it only lasted 12 hours, and I'm really back to my old self, so can I just go back to work? And the 48 hours is an additional buffer to make sure that we are really talking about a resolution of illness. It's not a firm number that. As of the 48th hour, you are no longer infective, but it is a good buffer in terms of what we've reviewed in the literature and sort of evidence of further transmission. Also, the duration of asymptomatic shedding of norovirus is really unknown. So like we said, you know, this buffer of 48 hours may not be the, you know, the absolute, and there may be the potential that even staff who return after the 48 hours of resolution of symptoms could potentially still be infectious, that really could still exist. I don't think we have solid evidence, however, to suggest either way as to the role of asymptomatic shedding. Next slide. So in terms of communication and notification, as with all outbreaks, particularly here in the U.S., it's fairly important to make sure that with that these types of outbreaks you notify the appropriate local and state health departments. They're usually part of regulations written into the state, into particular states. And so if any outbreak actually occurs, you're supposed to report them to your local and state department of health. Next slide. So the process of controlling suspected norovirus outbreaks, like any outbreak, this is a multifaceted approach. The key, however, is rapid identification using whatever method you can and action. In the general sequence of controlling these outbreaks, you want to identify your primary cases. You have epidemiologic info. Are there any commonalities in terms of person, time, and space to suggest that you're looking at maybe more than just one or two like sporadic cases, but that you're looking at the beginnings of an outbreak? The implementation of patient isolation and cohorting and the emphasis on personal hygiene practices, those are key. The implementation of good use of PPE as well as, you know, adherence to hand hygiene. Increased frequency and extent of environmental cleaning and disinfection, that must be also enacted very quickly, you know, in terms of ramping up the frequency and how many times that occurs during a day on these affected wards or areas. And then also early education and communication among staff, patients, and visitors. That's really important, too, because this may be something that's being brought in from the outside, from either the visitors' aspect of things, or they may be, unfortunately, affected by these, by going to visit their loved ones. And as we know, all three groups are are fairly equally susceptible to picking up norovirus. Next slide. So what happens when those primary infection control measures don't stop an outbreak? And this is, you know, I think the conundrum that everyone faces. What do you do when we did everything? So we have some of those supplemental infection control interventions, like I mentioned, the Category 2 recommendations. And they are basically, you know, at best modest evidence, but and unproven in terms of, you know, efficacy, but they do provide some kind of net benefit. So consider, as additional things, suspending group activities, extending those isolation periods among those particularly at-risk patient populations. And then, of course, the thing that has a lot of dollars attached to it is the unit and ward closure. And then also going with sort of a policy of limited inter or intra-facility transfers that might help, you know, control these particularly, you know, out-of-control types of circumstances. Next slide. And so what does the evidence show? Overall, the published evidence is generally descriptive and narrative in nature, and so it's really difficult to determine the contribution of any single intervention during outbreaks, and that's fairly true with all infection control, outbreak control measures. Control studies are not really possible or really ethical to implement at this time, so, you know, if it was there in sort of in the older literature, that'd be great, or controlling for other things, that was great to inform the body of evidence, but those types of studies may not actually be feasible. Environmental studies do demonstrate great, in some cases, in vitro benefits of certain disinfectants, but it's difficult to extrapolate how that works in real-world settings, and then how does the human norovirus strain respond to that when we don't really know what it's capable of being sensitive to or resistant to. Next slide. So just in a nutshell, here are some of the main components for outbreak control in healthcare settings. So the main interventions are cohorting, isolation, hand hygiene, best use of PPE, and environmental cleaning. Those are the big ones, but it's not to say that things like patient transfer and ward closure, as well as looking at aspects like how is patient food being handled, for example, and also the aspect of where and how often are visitors coming in and out of those affected areas. In terms of infrastructure and policy, the big ones are to basically being able to manage staff leave and the education of staff and visitors about norovirus to make sure that they either can recognize the symptoms early enough, and then also are able to use the appropriate control measures themselves. Communication and notification within the hospital is very important as well, or in other healthcare settings. And then also case detection. Active case finding is extremely useful in basically getting a better handle on how fast these outbreaks are occurring, if at all. And then also the use of diagnostics is also an important tool. Next slide. So in terms of identifying the gaps in the literature, there are several. So there is host contagiousness and transmission. So some of the things that came out of our guideline wasn't so much what did we know, but what don't we know. And so in terms of the gaps that we have yet to address is determining the correlations between prolonged shedding of norovirus after symptoms have subsided and the likelihood of secondary transmission of norovirus. Also determining the role of asymptomatic shedding among either recovered persons and carriers, also in secondary transmission. Next slide. In terms of environmental issues, we do need to quantify the effectiveness of both cleaning and disinfecting agents against norovirus or their appropriate surrogate, and evaluate the effectiveness and reliability of things that are new, the new and novel environmental disinfection strategies, such as you may have heard of fogging, UV irradiation, vapor phase, hydrogen peroxide, and ozone mist to reduce norovirus contamination. There's a lot of work in this area currently with different industry partners. And so, you know, as more literature becomes available and available to evaluate in the future, that would be something we could potentially update our guidelines with. At the time in which this guideline was being constructed, so primarily in 2009-2010, really the literature was quite sparse in terms of showing or demonstrating with norovirus in that mix how good these products really did work. Next slide. In terms of hygiene and infection control, we do strive to evaluate the effectiveness of FDA-compliant hand sanitizers against human norovirus or appropriate surrogates, including concepts of viral persistence after the treatment with things like non-alcohol-based products. And so this is an area that has had a lot of questions directed toward these types of, you know, efficacy claims and, you know, is it safe to use and is norovirus, killed in an appropriate quantity or, you know, log reductions? And these are all questions that are still unanswered at this time. And also assess the benefits and impact of implementing things like universal gloving practices during outbreaks of norovirus gastroenteritis. So that's something we really didn't see any evidence presented in the literature to see how the impact of just universal gloving did in terms of attenuating, you know, caseloads of norovirus overall in these types of outbreaks. Next slide. So in addition to the guideline that was published, and it went on our website probably in May or May of this year, and then, as I mentioned, published in the Infection Control Hospital Epidemiology Journal this October, we're in the process of putting together a toolkit for norovirus outbreaks in healthcare, and it should be available on our CDC website probably in the next month. And so not only is there a link to the HCPCS guideline that we've been basing most of our discussion this afternoon, but it also has things that we discussed, just basically highlights of the key infection control recommendations, templates for posters that people can use to, you know, educate their staff on, you know, what does norovirus look like in terms of do you have it, what should you do, general process measures to follow up on the detection of a gastrointestinal outbreak, so who do you contact, and what kind of process measures do you have in place, or what sort of resource do you have available to diagnose these types of outbreaks. Also, a flowchart to identify tiered options for the diagnostic support and contact information that you could fill out. It's basically a worksheet. Also, additional worksheets for line lists for tracking outbreak progress, and we've put our heads together. This is actually a joint venture between the group that I work in with the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion as well as Division of Viral Diseases. And so we've worked together in putting this whole toolkit together and also have worked together in constructing a communication framework for reporting outbreaks. And so that is, who do you contact when you first suspect an outbreak, and so that no one hopefully is forgotten when these communication is important too. So we've included that as part of the toolkit. So here's just some quick snapshots of what the toolkit will look like. So this is a sample communication framework. As you can see, there's just things across the top, department, their role, and some contact information that you can fill out, especially so that, you know, potentially ancillary services that don't normally get included in outbreaks do actually get a heads up. You know, for example, even linen services. Well, we're going to be needing more linens, more privacy curtains, more linens to send up because this area is actually experiencing an outbreak. So, you know, anticipate having more demand on coming from these areas. The next slide. This is also the personnel or patient line list to identify and keep track of your cases as they crop up. So we ask for, you know, just brief demographics, symptoms, outcome, diagnostics that were used. This can also be used if you wish to use to, you know, help to report. We can summarize all of this information at the bottom, you know, and total things up, like how many people were vomiting, how many started out with diarrhea, and that will be helpful also to report to your health departments as well. So it can serve as a tool for that as well. Also, next slide, we have a norovirus specimen form, and this is just a framework. This one will be probably changed a little bit because our names are in there. And so this was actually done as a pilot in 3 states that we piloted this toolkit last year. So this is a snapshot from that. But basically, who do you contact when you want to have specimens submitted? And your primary options being within your facility, secondary options, the local state public health laboratories, and tertiary options. If there are no resources available, we also have the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which do have some resources to test specimens, especially in, you know, unique outbreaks. So just let you know that that's part of the toolkit. Next slide. Here's just a sample poster that we created. It says, what is norovirus? What are the symptoms? Is it contagious, et cetera? And what can I do to prevent it? So we just created a fairly generic poster for healthcare providers. I did want to also bring your attention to our other guideline that was put out early this year, I believe in February, and it's from our colleagues in Division of Viral Diseases, and it's the CDC updated Norovirus Outbreak Management and Disease Prevention Guidelines, and it primarily focuses on outbreaks that occur in the community setting, but you know there are many overlaps between the two, so I just wanted to refer you to that as well in case that was a good resource to have. So, in summary, several of our key recommendations are here to assist in the control of norovirus outbreaks in healthcare settings. The recommendations are supported by available evidence, and we did an exhaustive review. I think we went through over 2,000 references to try and boil it down to several key recommendations. And it is the first norovirus guideline to systematically review and evaluate the literature. We don't know a lot about transmission dynamics and the best methods for hand hygiene and environmental disinfection, but we did do the best we could in terms of what was available in the literature and compile that for your consumption. Norovirus research does need to characterize the interventions used in outbreaks and measure the real-world efficacy. That was one of the main things that we did leave the guideline with, that, you know, there were some need to identify what kind of interventions work best still. So just so you know. And just in summary and in our final couple slides here together, I did want to acknowledge the CDC HICPAC Writing and Research Group. So not only was it HICPAC, the Healthcare Infection Control Practices Advisory Committee, which includes Russ, who's on the phone today, but also Kurt Stevenson, Krame Umscheid, Inji Lee, Raj Agarwal, and Gretchen Kuntz. And the latter four were at the University of Pennsylvania Health System. And then we also had external reviewers, John Boyce, Aaron Hall from Division of Viral Diseases, Cliff McDonald, who is in our division, and Umesh Parashar, who is also in Division of Viral Diseases. So thank you very much for your time today. And if you do have any questions, I think there's an opportunity to do that if you have things that were not clear today. But then also there's my email in case you have direct questions for me. Thanks.
Great. Well, thank you, Tara. That was excellent overview of the updated guidelines, and really appreciate the kind of synopsis of, you know, it's a fairly long document, but not too bad. And I did want to highlight a few things that this guideline reflects the new process that Tara went over in terms of applying a scoring tool to the strength and quality of studies that are published. And that's, you know, fairly new for HCPCS to be have begun doing. I think with the catheter-associated UTI guideline was the first one, but I think from my perspective, I think it's a very objective and clear approach to developing the language around the recommendations. So I think that was key there. But I did have one question for you, Tara. One of the key things infection preventionists bring is kind of early detection of a potential cluster, say, of norovirus infections. And like you, I have great respect for this pathogen. I think it's perfectly positioned to cause lots of disruption of normal activity. So, but I wondered, for, let's say, an inpatient clinical unit or even a residential setting such as long-term care facility or assisted living, do you have any tips as to what might give you a sense as an infection preventionist of a potential cluster brewing in terms of, say, number of cases over a short period of time? Or didn't know if you had some guideposts there that may maybe the listeners would be interested in.
Sure. We actually tried to pilot that last year, and it I don't know if we could say it was a raging success, but it was to look at two cases within 24 hours that were epidemiologically linked as sort of a, it was a very, very low threshold to call it an outbreak. But we decided, and this was in consultation with the norovirus group here at CDC, that that might be a place to go. There isn't anything published that said, here, go with, you know, go with this number, and that will give you a better sense of whether you've got an outbreak or not. But we decided to go with two or more cases within 24 hours as something that should be seen suspiciously, I think. So that might be some, and like I said, it hasn't been validated, but it was sort of on expert opinion at the time last year when we wanted to give something to those people who are piloting our toolkit to say, well, if you saw this, that might be where you would start. And you can go back and say, well, that didn't work. That was just two sporadic episodes, and it didn't work out to anything. But, you know, to err on the side of caution, I think that's why we went with that. So that might be something people might look at. And also just being able to be aware of what is going on in their local, like their regional setting, like if there is a, or being aware of outbreaks that are occurring around them, that you know that the season is upon us, you know that the norovirus also happens to occur closer to the winter months. So we're actually starting to see a number of outbreaks being reported that's been starting probably in the last few weeks. So, you know, this would also be the timing as well is also important to kind of consider. So if you're in this season around Christmas and you're starting to see that kind of activity, it would be something to sort of keep note of and maybe, you know, move on quicker than normal.
Great. And I think those are good guideposts for us to all be aware of. And this particular virus can strike fear in the hearts of healthcare providers, so it is very significant impact very quickly too, which is impressive. So, with that, again, we'd like to thank Dr. Tara McConnell this afternoon for presenting an overview of the norovirus prevention guidelines for outbreaks by CDC and HCPCS, and then also we'd like to thank Weber Training for hosting today's session, and our sponsor for today is Virox. And looking forward to having you tune in again next time. And with that, I'd like to thank you all for dialing in and thank our faculty for today. Again, Dr. McConnell, thanks so much.